Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. Last spring, the U.S. Supreme Court surprised many court watchers in upholding the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act. The High Court returns for a new term on October 1st. It's a term that could bring with it some more judicial fireworks, with cases on the docket addressing affirmative action, a global terrorism wiretapping program, and a Fourth Amendment case involving the legality of searches prompted by drug-sniffing dogs. Today on Focus, we will preview the Supreme Court's fall term. We'll discuss some of the cases the High Court is scheduled to hear, and we'll also talk a bit about how the High Court operates and consider what, if anything, we can read into the role Chief Justice Roberts may play in upcoming terms following his unexpected majority opinion in last term's health care ruling. We have two guests with us today. Lisa McElroy is an associate professor of law at Drexel University. Lisa, welcome to the program.
Hi, Craig. Thanks a lot.
Glad to have you with us. And Dan Hamilton is a professor of law and history here at the University of Illinois. Dan, thank you for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And we welcome you to the conversation as well. What would you like to know about how the Supreme Court operates, from the cases they agree to take, to oral arguments, to the process of writing and issuing rulings, to what we might expect from the nation's highest court in the fall term beginning October 1st? You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us. And our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. We also welcome your questions on WILL's Facebook page, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. Lisa, let me begin with you, and let's start with the Supreme Court's 5-4 ruling upholding the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act last spring, and specifically Chief Justice Roberts writing for the majority. That was a surprise to a lot of court watchers. Another surprise was that there was supposedly some sort of leak out of the Supreme Court indicating Roberts' ruling was also a surprise to some of the other justices, particularly the ones in the minority, and that I believe the claim goes Justice Scalia specifically was upset about it. The High Court's not known for leaks. What do you make of all of this?
Yeah, well, let's start with the chief and his writing the majority opinion in this 5-4 decision. And, of course, it wasn't that much of a surprise that the chief wrote the majority opinion. We all expected that because the chief has the assignment power, that if he was in the majority, he would keep this opinion for himself. This is, you know, one of the landmark cases, one of the biggest cases, I'd say, other than Bush v. Gore that we've seen in decades. And so we all thought that the chief might write it. I think the surprise was that the chief wrote it on this side. After the oral arguments, a lot of people speculated that the Supreme Court was going to strike down the Affordable Care Act. And so we thought that it would be Chief Justice Roberts with the three conservatives and with perhaps Justice Kennedy who would go this way. And the huge surprise was that he went over to the so-called liberal side of the court. And then, of course, this did spawn these leaks. And yes, leaks coming out of the Supreme Court are incredibly unusual. Everyone who works in that building knows that they absolutely cannot talk about the behind-the-scenes stuff outside of the building. In fact, the law clerks take an oath when they start there that they will not, and most of them uphold that oath for life. And so when we got these leaks breaking out of the Supreme Court within a couple of days of the decision, we court watchers were frankly pretty shocked.
Dan, what, if anything, could we extrapolate from Justice Roberts' decision in that case that may suggest how the High Court may rule in upcoming cases?
Well, I think there are a couple things that we can think about. I think the first thing that we see is the chief flexing his muscles just a little bit. Remember that this guy is relatively young compared to many of the other justices, and also remember that he argued before this court and before most of the members of this court. He argued 39 cases before the Supreme Court. He was known as one of the top Supreme Court advocates. And so in becoming chief, he really had to establish himself as the first among equals, as we call him. So part of what we saw was just the chief saying, hey, you're not the boss of me here. But I think another thing that we saw was the chief doing something that Dan Hamilton and I both know is a very important rule about how the court approaches cases. The court has to look, when they're looking at an act of Congress, when they're looking at a federal statute like the Affordable Care Act, they have to construe that act as constitutional, if it is at all possible to do so. So in other words, when the justices look at something that Congress has done, remember back in third grade when we talked about checks and balances, you learned that the different branches of government check and balance each other. The court really needs to defer to Congress if it can. And I think that that was what the chief did here in his majority opinion. I think he said, look, we can uphold this statute. Maybe I don't personally agree with it, but there's a way to do that, and so I'm legally bound to do so.
Dan?
Yeah, I agree with that. I also think that Justice Roberts was working to preserve the legitimacy of the court. And I'm not saying striking a vote to strike down the law would have been illegitimate. I'm saying that the issue in health care had become so politicized that striking down the law would have been perceived, or at least Justice Roberts thought it would have been perceived, as the court becoming increasingly partisan. So in the wake of the cases that Lisa mentioned, Bush v. Gore in 2000, and then Citizens United, which was famously condemned by the president in his 2010 State of the Union address, healthcare had become this huge political and social issue. This is probably the most significant piece of social legislation since the New Deal. And Roberts really, I think, stepped in to protect the public legitimacy of the court, because the court has historically sometimes done damage to itself in the Dred Scott case at the time of the Civil War, in the New Deal. And so he took the court out of the political arena, at least for this election cycle, which is to say, now President Obama is not campaigning against the court, and he has really preserved the legitimacy of the court in this term. Now, in terms of your other question about what it predicts, I'm not sure that it predicts very much, which is to say, John Roberts has not, as Jeffrey Toobin says in his book, most recent book, The Oath, discovered his inner moderate. Right, he is likely to go back to the positions he's long taken on the big issues before the court, namely on affirmative action and maybe on voting rights and maybe on same-sex marriage, where he has a more traditional voting pattern that I don't think he's going to change.
It does seem as if there have been in recent terms more 5-4 rulings on ideological grounds than maybe in past courts, at least the big rulings. Is that just a perception? Is that it? Can we actually look back and say, yeah, actually, there are a lot more 5-4 rulings than there have been, a lot more split sort of decisions by the court than in the past?
Well, actually, the statistics don't bear that out. It is true that when the court splits 5-4, it typically is on these really hotbed, you know, sort of ideological type issues, these social justice type issues. But the court splits 5-4 a lot less than the public seems to think it does. In fact, the court is usually, in most terms, unanimous more often than it splits 5-4.
That's exactly right. And last term, there were 15 5-4 cases. And as Lisa says, the vast majority were actually unanimous. Mm-hmm. Now, having said that, those 15 tend to be the high-stakes issues that draw the most attention. And that is a relatively new phenomenon, which is to say a reliable 5-4 split on the most prominent social and legal issues of our day.
And then I guess we would characterize the Affordable Care Act as an unpredictable 5-4 split, because Roberts sided with what have historically been characterized as the four more liberal justices versus the four more conservative justices.
Yes, an extremely rare, maybe unprecedented, at least I don't know, maybe unprecedented 5-4 lineup.
I actually think it is an unprecedented lineup. And in fact, a lot of the people who follow the court very closely had sort of crunched the numbers to look and see, has this ever happened, even before. And that was why everybody was saying there's just no way he can possibly vote that way. He never has.
Lisa, let's leave last spring's term behind and talk a little bit about what happened over the summer at the Supreme Court since that last ruling in the spring. What happens at the court while the justices are gone?
Well, the first thing that's going to happen is after we announce all these opinions, the chief will typically thank the people who work at the court and he'll give awards. For example, a couple of years ago, he always gives awards for service of some period of time. A couple of years ago, he gave an award to two of the dogs that work at the court. We're going to get to dogs a little bit later, I know, because in dog years, they had so many years of service at the court. So he always acknowledges that. And then the justices tend to leave the building, just like Elvis. They tend to go off and teach somewhere. The chief has a vacation home in Maine, so he was in Malta for a while this summer, and then he went to Maine and, you know, ate lobster just like the rest of us. But meanwhile, it's very, very busy within the building. Each of the justices has four law clerks, and these are recent law school graduates, and their job is to really deal with the summer, with the vast amount of petitions that come to the court. These are documents that are asking the court to hear the cases. And, of course, the court gets about 8,000 of these a year and typically agrees to hear, grants certiorari, in about 1%. So in recent years, we've seen about 70 to 80 cases granted out of this huge pile. So the clerks are working very hard all summer. They're busy bees in the hive, going through this stack of petitions and trying to figure out what to recommend to the justices. Now, coming up this coming week, the justices will have what's called their long conference. And their long conference is where they will sit and they will look through all the memos that clerks have written over the summer and try to figure out, okay, which cases are we going to hear? As of today, the court has only agreed to hear 33 cases in this Supreme Court term. And, of course, we know that means they're going to grant probably about 40 more.
And how does the Supreme Court ultimately decide what cases to hear? What are they typically looking for?
Well, the biggest thing that they're looking for is what's called a circuit split. And if you understand that the court is divided up into geographical circuits, they're districts, where we have federal courts that sit there. We have the Federal Courts of Appeals. There are 13 of them. And the biggest thing that the court is looking for is where the Federal Courts of Appeals disagree with each other on some important issue of federal law. So, for example, you wouldn't want it to be that people who live in Montana can have dogs sniffing around their homes, but people who live in Georgia can't. So what the court will do is they will see, the federal law is inconsistent across the country, and that's when it's their job to take the issue and resolve it.
All right. So, Dan, we're looking ahead now to this fall term that begins October 1st. Do you see any potential for something as unexpected or explosive as the Affordable Care Act ruling? And I guess you had pointed out off air, immigration ruling by the court in the last term also was, a couple of rulings were fairly potentially explosive, you might characterize them as such.
I think both the health care law ruling and the immigration ruling that struck down major parts of the Arizona law about searching people suspected of being undocumented residents were major victories for the president that people could not necessarily have predicted. I think this term, in terms of what's most up for grabs, is same-sex marriage. It's just a very interesting lineup, and we don't know how that's going to go.
And that's one that thus far the court has not indicated it will hear, but there's every expectation that the court will hear one of a couple possible cases involving same-sex marriage, right?
Right. I mean, as Lisa points out, once you have a circuit that's made a ruling and you've got a split circuit courts, it's hard to see how they can't hear it. So the circuit court out of Boston, the First Circuit, has held that the Defense of Marriage Act is largely unconstitutional. So one circuit court has made that ruling. Mm-hmm. That means we could have a law that is unconstitutional in one circuit and constitutional in the rest of the circuits. So that's hard. It's hard to imagine how the court won't hear at least that challenge to DOMA.
But there's also been court challenges to California's Prop 8 state constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage.
Right.
And so there's some question about whether the court will look at the DOMA case or whether they'll look at the Prop 8 case, and what's the difference? Why would it matter?
It matters a lot which they look at. So Proposition 8 was an amendment to the California State Constitution which flat out banned gay marriage. And that is working its way through the courts, and that is an issue that is joined on the question, is it constitutional to ban gay marriage under the Equal Protection Clause and possibly the Due Process Clause? That case presents the issue very squarely. DOMA is a little different. The Defense of Marriage Act is a federal law passed that says, for purposes of any federal benefit, whenever you see the word marriage in any federal law, marriage shall be interpreted to be meaning only between a man and a woman. So, for instance, in Social Security survivor benefits, right? If it says the word marriage, that is only between a man and a woman under federal law. So that goes to benefits and not necessarily the actual question of the constitutionality of the law itself. So if the court wants to reach a narrow ruling where it does not get to the due process claim of whether or not this is a fundamental right, it can do it under DOMA, but not under Proposition 8. I see no way for them to avoid the major constitutional issue under Proposition 8.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing the Supreme Court on today's show. The High Court's fall term begins October 1st. We're discussing some of the cases the court has agreed to hear and may ultimately hear during this term. My guests are Lisa McElroy, Associate Professor of Law at Drexel University, and Daniel Hamilton, Professor of Law and History here at the University of Illinois. We welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again is 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. Lisa mentioned earlier dogs, so let's get to the dog case here. Actually, it's a couple of cases, Florida v. Jardines and Florida v. Harris. Both of these cases involve the use of drug-sniffing dogs, and this, I imagine, Dan, is a Fourth Amendment question about search and seizure.
Yes.
So what is being considered here? What about the Fourth Amendment, and what about what drug-sniffing dogs can or cannot do? Or what more specifically, what police can do based off of the behavior of those dogs?
So the Fourth Amendment protects against unreasonable searches and seizures. So the question then is always, what's reasonable and what's a search? So the court up till now has held that a dog sniffing the outside of your suitcase or the outside of your car does not amount to a search. So if a dog indicates that there's drugs inside a suitcase, then that gives enough cause that allows you to search that suitcase. The question coming out of Florida is, if the dog indicates that there's drugs inside a car, can you then go inside the car? Does the police officer have enough evidence to actually search the interior of the car? And this is the most recent in a long line of dog cases. And the Supreme Court held several years ago that a sniff is not a search, which is to say, a dog sniffing anything, that maybe, does not rise to the level of a search. Mm. Having said that, it might be different when it's either the interior of your car or maybe most importantly, the interior of your house.
So they couldn't bring drug-sniffing dogs to your front door, and if the dogs suddenly start barking, say, okay, now we have reason to go into your home and look for drugs.
They cannot. The question is, if a dog, let's say you bring a dog up to the front porch of someone's house, and the dog indicates that there's drugs inside the house, is that enough to go get a warrant and to then have reasonable cause to then search the house? So the courts have been very protective of the home as being the bedrock place of privacy, where you have the greatest expectation of privacy under the Fourth Amendment. So the notion that a dog sniff could be the way to get cause to search a house is what the court is hearing now. And that's a very interesting question about how far the court is going to let this form of search, if you think it is a search, take place.
Lisa, any idea what kinds of questions the justices may ask during oral arguments or what some of the constitutional implications are that they may be considering?
Sure, Craig. So, you know, this is so much fun, and listening to Dan talk, I'm just getting all excited here, because you have to understand that October and, you know, the Supreme Court term starts the first Monday of October. So this year, that's October 1st. And for people like Dan and me, this is like going into postseason in baseball. I mean, this is just like the most exciting thing, and it's so interesting. Because if you think about it, we've got two different lines of law here, don't we? We've got the line of law that says your home is a really private place, and that should be, right? You don't want to be in your home and, for example, in a case that the court decided like 10 years ago, them taking heat detection devices and looking inside your home, right? We don't want them to be able to do that. That doesn't sound right. And then we've got this line of cases that says, well, a dog sniffing isn't so bad. That's okay. We'll let that happen. Well, what about when the two of those come together? So I think what the justices are going to be asking about is, really, which way should we go with this? Isn't it really different because it's a home? Doesn't the Constitution really provide for, if not overtly, then at least through our rulings, people being able to be in their home and have some confidence that they're not going to get invaded by the police, right? But on the other hand, isn't it good to let the police officers use the tools that they have to do their job? And then I think there's a whole other dimension to this, too. We're talking about dogs here. And, you know, we're putting so much faith in these dogs. And from what I know, these dogs are actually very reliable. But think about it. These dogs are sniffing, and they're giving the police a huge amount of power. And with a conservative court like this one, this court doesn't like criminal defendants very much. It's going to be very, very tempting to say, well, what do we do? Don't we want the police to be able to get these drug criminals off the streets?
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing the Supreme Court with Lisa McElroy, Associate Professor of Law at Drexel University, and Daniel Hamilton, Professor of Law and History here at the University of Illinois. We welcome your questions and comments about the upcoming fall term at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome questions via WILL's Facebook and Twitter pages. Our Twitter handle's Will Public Media. The phone number again is 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. We have an email from Ryan in Gibson City. He asks, in regards to an issue like Citizens United, what are the rules on the Supreme Court rehearing an issue they have already ruled on?
Well, historically, once they've ruled, they try not to rule because they want the precedent to take. Having said that, in the recent Commerce Clause line of cases that ultimately led to the Supreme Court's ruling in the health care law, they were switching very quickly. So I think that unless there's a change in personnel on the court, they won't rehear Citizens United. Having said that, this presidential election could well produce a change of personnel on the court. And then, as Lisa said, all you need are justices who want to hear the case, and they get to hear that case.
And you don't even need a majority of justices. All you need is four justices to say, we'd like to hear this case. So certainly there are probably a couple of them who are just waiting for that change in membership to happen. If people are really interested in this issue, I want to highly recommend a new book that's just out called Supreme Myths. It's by a guy named Eric Siegel, who's a professor at Georgia State. And it explains how when the court changes, that's when the law tends to change, too. And we have seen this happen. I mean, one of the cases that's coming up this term, and Dan, I'd love to know your thoughts on this, is an affirmative action in a higher education case.
And this
And, you know, we really did have a decision on a case that was very, very close less than 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. But what's happened in those 10 years? The court membership has changed. And so we might come out with a very different result.
I want to get to that affirmative action case. But first, Dan, let me ask you in regards to Citizens United and campaign finance itself. Just because the court may not hear that the specifics of that particular legal challenge again, there may be other elements that they want to pursue, or there may be exceptions to the previous ruling that they hadn't considered in their prior ruling. Are there other campaign finance issues that may come to the court, either in this coming term or in future terms?
The answer is always yes. We should say this will be litigated. It was such a broad ruling, and the court can walk it back if it wants to, particularly if the circuit courts below walk it back, if they find ways to narrow the very broad holding of Citizens United. Having said that, there's very little evidence that the majority in Citizens United wants to do anything other than maintain Citizens United. So I do not predict that will happen.
And it's important to note, taking off on what Dan just said, because the court has such enormous discretion in which cases they grant, just because these cases might be sort of floating around in the lower courts, all the court has to do is just say, sorry, we don't feel like hearing this. And so they get so much discretion in their selection that it's always hard to predict. And every term, we get really surprised by some cases that aren't granted that we really expect will be.
Mm-hmm. Paul has been waiting patiently on the line. Let's take his call now. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you. The one thing about the Citizens United case, which I didn't call about, is it was broadened in a rather unprecedented way. So it makes it, I think, a good one for revisiting. I had a couple of things, and the question about the ACA I'd like for you to return to is twofold as well. And one of the things is they adjudicated it on not the Commerce Clause. The four judges known as liberal did make those arguments, but they joined with Thomas on this other idea, which I forget what the...
Roberts. They joined with Roberts, and this had to do with the notion that it was a tax, and that's how they maintained the constitutionality of the federal mandate. Is that what you were
right,
looking at?
Right, yeah. But the basis of that is something that some scholars have been saying is actually sort of a kind of a new precedent, and they expect maybe the Roberts court, Roberts court to use that in some way. in the future that is a little bothersome to some, again, so-called liberal judges. But the other part, I've never heard anybody succinctly and clearly explain the ruling, the part of the ruling about the Medicare expansion. Is it states' rights? Is they're talking about it's coercive of the federal government to not give money if you don't participate in the program. That's done all the time, and that has implications as well, it seems.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Okay. I did have another whole dimension, but I guess I don't get to.
Well, if you could describe it quickly.
Well, I just it seems to me the Supreme Court in the Hamdan case ruled on preventive detention and habeas corpus in a way that they're actually not applying to lower courts that have been denying, appeals of certain cases that are comparable. So it looks to me like that we have this Hamdan case hanging out there, and then we have this, particularly the D.C. Circuit saying, we don't even want to talk about this issue, we don't even want to deal with it, but the Supreme Court precedent is that they ought to, and they ought to. I don't know if that's clear enough.
All right.
The Center for Constitutional Rights has a lot on this. So.
All right. Thanks very much for the call, and Dan, you were nodding your head as he was talking.
Yeah, so let's do this one by one.
Sure.
So he's exactly right that everyone expected this to be a Commerce Clause case. Everyone was ready to go. How is the court going to interpret the Commerce Clause? And then it relied upon the taxing power to uphold the law. The taxing power historically is close to unlimited, and it doesn't get litigated very often on that basis, that we have not really found an outer limit to the taxing power. And we were searching for one here in the Commerce Power. The taxing power remains close to unlimited. That means that we don't know if Roberts has given the Congress a very powerful new weapon. Namely, don't pass legislation asserting authority under the Commerce Clause of the Constitution. Do it under the taxing power of the Constitution. So that might be an unintended consequence of this law.
But only if you believe that there's anybody in Congress that wants to put out a tax, which they seem to go to great pains to say the Affordable Care Act mandate was not until it became a way to uphold it within the Supreme Court.
One of the best rumors coming out of this case was that the Obama administration gave instructions to go through the law, and everywhere it said the word tax, put the word mandate. So because they were worried that the word tax would make it politically unpopular. Having said that, Roberts then reached out to call that mandate a tax. And of course it's a tax. So it was actually the fact that it was a tax that saved it constitutionally.
If I could throw something in
please.
Here. Dan is absolutely right, and the caller is absolutely right, that we fully expected this to be a case decided under the Commerce Clause. And that, of course, is why a lot of news outlets, CNN and Fox, got it wrong when they first called the decision in this case. I was not at the court when this opinion came down, but I was sitting in an NPR studio in New York waiting to go on the air, and I had up on my computer SCOTUS blog, which is the major blog about the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. the New York Times, and CNN.com, so that I could look, and as soon as it came down, I would know what had happened. And of course, SCOTUS blog was saying it's still a good law, CNN was saying it's been struck down, and the New York Times was saying we don't know yet. Well, what happened there was that the first thing in the opinion was it said this isn't valid under the Commerce Clause. And so some people just stopped reading there. And you actually had to turn the page to see that it had been upheld under the tax power. It's a very unusual way to construct an opinion also. Usually the major holding in the case will come first. So there was a ton of confusion. And, you know, of course, it has been reported that even President Obama thought it had been struck down for about 5 minutes.
The phrase, don't judge a book by its cover, comes to mind, doesn't it? Don't judge a ruling by its first paragraph.
Exactly.
It's more evidence, perhaps, that Robert switched sides. And I should say, he says it was unconstitutional under the Commerce Clause, and then he upholds the law. So what's the consequence of him saying that about the Commerce Clause? We don't know.
Why do you even do that?
Right.
I mean, the other thing, and I think the caller is lit on something very important, is that some people have said that Robert succeeded in doing exactly what he wanted to, which was in limiting the Commerce Clause.
That could be. And I should say the caller is also right that a major part of the opinion is that the Medicare part of the law, which would have expanded Medicare massively in the states, was ruled unconstitutional as violating the conditional spending power of the Congress, saying, if you're going to take our money, you've got to do X, Y, and Z. The court said there's a limit to that, That's a limit we haven't seen before. That's potentially serious part of this opinion that, in my opinion, is not getting enough. I would recommend the work of my colleague at the law school, Richard Kaplan, who writes about this quite a lot. But that's a major part of the opinion we're not talking about enough.
Dan, what about the other subject Paul raised?
So the question of preventive detention is a very interesting one. It's where the court has ruled quite forcefully, if you ask me, on the side of limiting presidential power and upholding, if you ask me, civil liberties with respect to the war on terrorism. But the court did kick the case back to the circuit and district courts, which, as the caller points out, he's exactly right, is now essentially not upholding a vigorous habeas corpus regime. So it is undermining the major decisions in Hamdan and Boumediene that we'll see if the court comes back to that case, particularly if it seems to be an issue that Kennedy cares about a lot. And if he senses that the district courts and circuit courts are undermining those major holdings, they may step back in.
We need to talk in just a minute or two about another case that the Supreme Court will hear that I think is of particular interest to college campuses across the country, a case involving how race can be considered in admissions to state colleges. But we are overdue for a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, why is our high-speed internet slower and our bills higher than in many other countries? And why is it many Americans don't even have access yet? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter David K. Johnston about his new book, The Fine Print. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Today's programs are made possible by Silver Creek in downtown Urbana, serving lunch and dinner every day with a brunch on Sunday. For 20 years, Silver Creek has served fresh and seasonally current dinners by the fireplace in warm wood ambience. Silver Creek offers over 100 of the world's finest wines and draft beers.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guests today are Lisa McElroy, Associate Professor of Law at Drexel University, and Daniel Hamilton, Professor of Law and History here at the University of Illinois. We're discussing the upcoming Supreme Court term. It begins October 1st, and the High Court will hear a number of intriguing cases dealing with issues ranging from affirmative action to wiretapping to one we talked about before, drug-sniffing dogs, and beyond. We welcome you to the conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.com. The phone number again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Dan, let's talk about Fisher v. University of Texas at Austin. The court's going to hear this case involving how race can be considered in admissions to state colleges. What are the major questions at play before the court?
So in 2003, the court handed down two cases called Grutter and Gratz that upheld race-conscious admissions in the University of Michigan Law School if race was a plus factor and not the decisive factor in admissions. And it at the same time struck down an undergraduate admissions program that assigned points on the basis of race and other things. And Justice O'Connor, who I think it's interesting to point out, was the only former legislator on the bench on the Supreme Court, had crafted this kind of compromise that she predicted, that she asked quite openly, be preserved for 25 years. And she did that in 2003 in a very dramatic affirmative action case that more or less protected affirmative action for 25 years, we thought. Now it looks as though that might be at risk. So the state of Texas does have a race-conscious admissions program in which 85% of the students of the University of Texas are let in if they're in the top 10% of their graduating class. And the remaining 15%, race is allowed as a factor, not the decisive factor, but as a factor in a holistic appreciation or a reading of the application.
So the individual in this case that sued basically claimed, well, she had fallen underneath that top 10%.
Right.
Was part of the 15% under consideration for admission for which race was a factor, a plus factor, as you indicated. And so on that basis, she claims she was not accepted because she did not fall into that minority status.
That's right. She said it's a violation of the Equal Protection Clause for the state of Texas to consider race in its admissions decisions.
And just to get sort of everyone up to speed on this, when you talk about the Equal Protection Clause, this is what, the 14th Amendment?
Yes.
And what does it say? What's the point of it?
It says equal protection shall not be denied on the basis of race and other things. Operative word here is race. So the interpretation of Justice Roberts and others is that means the state essentially cannot take race into account except to undo discrimination. The view of the liberal justices on the court is that there's a fundamental difference between racial discrimination designed to hurt a minority and racial discrimination designed to benefit and redress centuries of inequality against a minority. And that fundamental constitutional split, we thought, which of course is a hugely controversial topic in public policy more broadly, we thought had been settled, at least in 2003, thanks to the work of Justice O'Connor. And now the issue is just joined again. And it looks as though the court, I mean, Lisa can tell us, I'm not sure, it looks as though the court is going to hear this case. And if it does, that could have a dramatic impact on public higher education, public education.
And not only that, Lisa, I understand another interesting wrinkle in this case is that Justice Kagan has recused herself from it.
That's right. Yeah, so this case is going to be argued on October 10th. So it's one of the very first cases that we're going to hear this term. And one of the problems is that Justice Kagan, who was formerly Solicitor General of the United States, has had to recuse herself. She will not be participating in deciding the case because this case was being discussed when she was in the SG's office. So this is a really big problem for the people who want to uphold affirmative action in admissions, because we have only eight now justices sitting. And, of course, Justice O'Connor, who wrote the majority opinion in the 2003 cases that Dan was talking about, is no longer on the court. Who replaced her? Justice Alito replaced her. And Justice Alito is more in the, as Chief Justice Roberts has said, the way to stop discriminating on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race camp. And so we have now Justice Alito taking that spot. Justice Kagan isn't there. It seems really likely that this could be a situation where we could see a really big change in the law. Probably our best hope is if the court splits 4-4. And if it splits 4-4, that happens once or twice a term, then we would just affirm the decision of the lower court.
Right. And now we're once again watching Justice Kennedy to see what he does.
We sure are. We're watching. Justice Kennedy is the most powerful man in the United States right now. There's no question at all. Obama doesn't even come close.
So if there is a 4-4 ruling or a ruling to uphold things as they are, then they continue as they are. But if not, what does this mean? What are the implications then for campuses across the country when it comes to their admissions policies? I imagine there would be a lot of review taking place.
Sure. Well, first of all, we should emphasize that this only applies to public universities. Private schools can do whatever they want.
That's right.
Although if they receive public funds, it's a little fuzzy. But, you know, the reason these come up at University of Michigan, University of Texas, is because these are huge, outstanding public universities that want to diversify their classes. And what we're going to see if they can't use measures to make sure that that happens is that we are going to see fewer and fewer people of color who are being accepted, perhaps, at least for some time. That was one reason why Justice O'Connor had that 25-year thing in there. And she said in Grutter, she said, you know, hopefully in 25 years we won't need it anymore, because a lot of the historical problems that have come up through the historical discrimination will have managed to work their way out, you know, in a couple of generations.
Yes, and that will have an impact on our community here at the University of Illinois, which is to say, if race-conscious admissions is deemed unconstitutional, that will affect public education quite dramatically across the country and also in our community.
Would it have any impact on employment and affirmative action policies for people seeking jobs?
Well, what's interesting is that, as in Citizens United, a court can rule broadly or narrowly, and we'll see what they do with this. If they rule broadly, then it could have very wide-ranging effects. It could, in the Grutter case, diversity, the racial diversity, was held by Justice O'Connor to be a compelling rationale for why the government can take note of race. If diversity is struck down as a compelling rationale for using race-conscious education, it's hard to see why it would withstand scrutiny in other areas. So it could have ripples effects well beyond public higher education. This is the dramatic, if you ask me, this is the dramatic case of this upcoming term.
Absolutely. And I think that going back to what we were talking about the Affordable Care Act, this might be one reason why, as Dan said, Chief Justice Roberts was so concerned about keeping the legitimacy of the institution. He had more work to do beyond the Health Care Act. He wanted to get some other jobs done. This is certainly one of the other jobs he wants to get done.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and there's still time for your questions or comments about the Supreme Court's new fall term beginning October 1st. You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. All right, let's go to another case that I've sort of alluded to through the hour. Clapper et al. V. Amnesty International. The court's considering whether individuals or groups that are afraid sensitive conversations might be monitored have a right to go to court to challenge this wiretapping program. So this deals with a fairly controversial subject of the last decade, really, whether or not there are limits that can be placed on the federal government wiretapping in the interests of security as they're seeking what they believe to be potential terrorist threats, right?
Yeah. So the Patriot Act, of course, expanded executive authority quite a lot within the area of the war on terror. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act has also been amended to allow warrantless electronic surveillance of non-U.S. citizens outside the United States. Having said that, everyone admits it will also capture some conversations from U.S. citizens. So groups of lawyers and journalists and human rights advocates have sued, saying it violates their Fourth Amendment right. Now, the tricky part here is that no one will admit who is actually being monitored. So, So the person suing doesn't know if they're being listened to. And they don't have what we call, in legal terms, maybe standing. The question is one of standing. Can you sue if you think you're being monitored but you're not sure?
Yeah, and think of all the people who think they're being monitored who really aren't.
So the law requires that you've been injured. And it's hard to know if the court will say the possibility that you are likely to be monitored is enough to give you standing to sue in this court, right? You're a prominent you're a prominent group like Amnesty International. Odds are you're going to have these types of conversations, so you can sue. This is one of the areas we love as law professors where these very technical legal issues actually are very crucial to these big public policy questions.
Well, and it's
and they affect real people, right, which I think is so important. I mean, think about it. Maybe you are someone who has a lot of family in the Middle East or something, and you're calling home. I mean, this affects real people, just like having a dog come up to your front door and sniff. And I think people think that the court is really removed from them, when really, you know, you're applying to college. You're living in a residential neighborhood. All of this stuff really applies to your friends, to your colleagues.
Dan, it seems like a couple of the cases the court's going to hear this term really deal with the 14th Amendment. A couple of cases really deal with the Fourth Amendment specifically. Mm-hmm. So we've been talking about issues over search and seizure, from drug-sniffing dogs to wiretapping. Mm-hmm. We've been talking about 14th Amendment equal protection in terms of admissions. We talked earlier about DOMA and same-sex marriage, and that could potentially apply under equal protection. What does it say that it seems like the Supreme Court is hearing a lot of cases that deal with those particular amendments to the Constitution? What does it say about America today?
Well, the Equal Protection Clause and the Due Process Clause, both passed in the wake of the Civil War, have really been the focal point for some of the great national debates over the most important issues of our time, turning from racial integration in Brown v. Board, to abortion, to the right to marry, to the right to sexual intimacy, to the right to privacy. It just happens that that is where we locate these fights. Equal protection and due process are phrases that are sufficiently broad that it gives courts room to maneuver, to have very pronounced ideological debate, and that is where we have these fights. That's where we locate these fights. It's not necessarily the case that we have to. We could locate them in the commerce power or the taxing and spending power. But the phrases equal protection and due process mean very different things to different people. So that's what gets that's the focal point for these fundamental debates.
And then what about the question of search and seizure? Why is that popping up more often?
I would say because if this is now me just saying my view, because the court has been quite lenient toward law enforcement over a long period of time, and we're reaching, not lenient, the court has been upholding the powers of law enforcement generally, particularly any place outside the home has gotten more and more intervention on the part of the law enforcement. So I think we're reaching sort of a place where the justices are saying, wait a minute, maybe we've gone too far. Having said that, what makes those cases so interesting is that it's very, very hard to predict who's going to vote which way. The criminal cases are just fascinating for that reason, because all this ideological stuff breaks down and weird alliances are formed. And for that purposes, for us court watchers, it's just fun. It's fascinating.
So fun. There's a fantasy Supreme Court, you know, just like there's fantasy baseball. And we really do play it. It's a lot of fun. Let me just add something to what Dan said, if that's okay.
Sure.
You know, you're absolutely right that these issues come up over and over and over again. You know, these are sort of the bread and butter of what the Supreme Court does. But remember how I said a little while ago that the Supreme Court has granted already 33 cases for review this term, and we've really only talked about four here. And so, in fact, the criminal part of the docket is under 20%. And so what we tend to do is, and I think rightfully so, you know, for shows like this, is focus on the exciting cases, the really interesting cases. But a lot of the court's work is pretty, you know, workaday. They're deciding bankruptcy stuff, and they're deciding stuff about employment benefits, and they're deciding tax issues. And, you know, that doesn't make for great radio, but it's a very real part of what they do and probably the majority of what they do.
Mm-hmm. We have just a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to ask each of you how you think this year's presidential election might affect the court going forward. Lisa?
This is going to be a very, very critical election, and that is because the court is getting older and older, and so two things can happen. One thing that can happen is that people will choose to retire, and the other thing that can happen is that when you have older people, they might, you know, have ill health. We saw that, for example, with Chief Justice Rehnquist and with Thurgood Marshall. And so whoever is president for the next 4 years is going to have an opportunity probably to appoint at least one, and I would guess more justices than that. And it's really the biggest legacy that any president has. You know, on the West Wing, President Bartlet, who was never really president, said, you know, this is what people are going to look back and really see a generation from now. Because typically, very young people, relatively, are being appointed to the court, typically people in their late 40s, early 50s, and they are going to be able to serve for 20, 30, even 40 years. And they're going to make a lot of law in that time. So they're going to serve through 8 to 10 presidents, and then the law that they make is going to stand for many, 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 many years beyond their actual service. And so the appointment power is a very, very important power, and it's one that I think the American public ignores some of the time.
Dan, I that's true any time with any presidential campaign. Mm-hmm. What's specific about this presidential campaign and the makeup of this particular court at this moment?
So Justice Ginsburg is 79 years old, and she'll turn 80 in March. She has had cancer. And
Twice.
Yep. Yes. And if she either retires or something happens to her under a, let's say, Romney administration, that will be the first time in a long time that a president has been able to appoint someone from the ideological group, not his own, right? So that would produce potentially a new 5-4 solid majority, which is, as Lisa points out, incredibly important in terms of law decades from now. The implication, I guess, is that Justice Ginsburg will stick around if President Romney is elected, if she can. And this is what we've seen more and more. We've seen what looks to be justices timing their resignations based on who is president or who's about to become president. I don't know if you agree with that, Lisa.
Oh, I absolutely do. But then we also know that stuff happens. For example, Thurgood Marshall had to retire during President Bush I's presidency. He was old and sick. And he took a lot of criticism for that because who got appointed? Clarence Thomas got appointed. So, yes, they try to control it, but it's not always within their control.
Right. But it looks as though O'Connor waited for a Republican president. It looks as though Souter and Stevens waited for a Democratic president.
Sure.
And we'll see if Obama's elected president, there actually might not be very much shift, which is to say the conservative bloc on the court looks relatively robust, which is to say.
So to speak.
Yes. So that bloc is probably not going anywhere. So that's actually would be status quo. Now, maybe people retire because maybe Ginsburg retires then.
Right. And we know that with Obama, based on his past two appointments, he doesn't go as liberal in his appointments as some liberals would like him to. Whereas Romney has stated explicitly that if he were to become president, he would nominate people like Robert Bork, who are ultra-conservative, and do that gladly and maybe get the Senate support to be able to push that through.
I'm afraid we're at the end of our time, but I want to say thanks to both of you. Lisa McElroy is an associate professor of law at Drexel University. Lisa, thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks so much, Greg.
And Daniel Hamilton is a professor of law and history here at the University of Illinois. Dan, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. You can go to it directly at will.illinois.edu/focus, or we are likely the first result on your search engine under WILL Focus. On tomorrow's show, we regularly present programs on personal finance to give you an opportunity to ask some basic questions about money management. Our guest will be Kevin Waspy, lecturer of finance at the University of Illinois College of Business. Whether you are just starting out and are looking for advice on investing or are thinking about buying a home or sending your kids to college or planning for retirement, whatever the case may be, your questions will be welcome. That's on tomorrow's program. Today's show was produced by Travis Stansel. Other members of our Focus team are Pam Dempsey, Kimberly Cronick, and Jim Meadows. Kyle Mabry is our technical director. He handles your calls. I'm Craig Cohen. Thanks for joining us.